We're about to have a conversation with Margaret Russell, who is a law professor at Santa Clara University and co-authored, along with Margaret Burnham, an op-ed in the New York Times called The Cold Cases of the Jim Crow Era, which we've talked about before, and I think is one of the critical issues that are facing us if we're going to solve the future before we let the past, if we don't deal with the past. So, Margaret, welcome. Good to have you with us on the show.
Thank you.
So this is a really interesting article that the two of you wrote, but I want to just start from the beginning for our listeners who may not even know what we mean by a cold case. When it comes to the civil rights era, we're not talking about some TV drama here, but instead some that the cases of hundreds, if not thousands, some would argue, of black Americans who died between 1930 and 1960, where their cases were unsolved.
That's absolutely right. So when we use the word cold cases, every cold case, which is an old unsolved case, is, of course, an injustice. But as we look at the cold cases of the Jim Crow era, we see, in addition to just the injustice of a loss of a life, a lot of information about crimes against blacks during that time period that you mentioned, conspiracies or complicity by governments that are never talked about. And it's really only in investigating these cases before time slips away that we can learn a lot about the bedrock of racism in our country.
I mean, it's interesting to me that one of the pieces you said in the article was that there's this huge, as you put it, robust archive of 1882 to 1930 of lynchings in America that were part of the terror campaign against the black community, especially in the South. But so little is known about what happened in the 30 years before 1960, when so many black people were murdered, and their murderers never brought to justice, and their cases just forgotten. How is that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, partly the reason why there's such a robust archive in the area of lynchings is because of a lot of hard work over a long period of time. That certainly was not easy to build up. We think, however, that the reason why there are these, you know, huge gaps from really 1930 on is, first of all, because I think there's this false impression that that racial discrimination and racial violence was diminishing to the extent that it really wasn't going on. And I think anybody, particularly blacks who lived in the South during this period, know that it absolutely was going on. So there wasn't as much attention paid to that. And as the decades went by, and particularly when the Brown v. Board decision happened in 1954, a lot of people thought, all right, well, Jim Crow is over. We're a colorblind society, or we're getting ever close to it. And in fact, the racially motivated violence really continued and often occurred in communities and with people that nobody paid attention to. So these crimes were never solved, and no one, it's as though people pretended that they never happened.
But what's interesting to me in all this, I mean, we're looking at cases. When we're talking about before 1960, I mean, the chances are of anybody being alive who was involved are pretty slim. I mean, maybe, but that was 60 years ago, almost 70 years ago, I should say. So where do we go with this?
I mean, well, slim but not impossible. And maybe I'll just give you a couple of brief examples of why it's still important now to solve the cold cases. There is an example. Actually, there's a beautifully written book called At the Dark End of the Street that is in part about what happened to an elderly black woman named Recy Taylor, who was raped. And you've probably talked about this on the show. And in the course of her lifetime, even though she was probably 90 when this apology was tendered, because of the investigation, this information was uncovered. She did receive an official apology and other restitution, and that's very important. Now, when you look at cases, let's say, for example, the Emmett Till case, which was investigated in the 2000s by the Department of Justice. The file was reopened not because it was unknown who his primary killers were. Everybody knew about that because, in fact, they confessed to it after they were acquitted. But there were additional people who may have participated in it, who it may have helped them along the way. Though some of those people were still alive, descendants of some of those people were still alive, and it was very important. Even if you wind up not – getting full justice in the case, because how could you? It's very important to know what the connections were.
I think that it's important to kind of push me out here. I mean, that the violence that took place against hundreds, and I say some argue thousands, whatever that, we don't even know what the real number is. Maybe we do, and you can tell us that.
Mm-hmm.
But the violence that took place against black people in the South between the 1930s and 1960s was particularly vicious, because that was the point where people were standing up and going, where the beginnings of the movement really were, post-World War II and more, saying we have a right to be full citizens. And so and the reaction was severe by individuals and groups. So, I mean, I think we don't sometimes all don't understand the full import of the particular period and what happened then.
Yes, and first to talk about numbers,
yeah.
It's at least several hundred. And as more and more investigations take place, not only into deaths but acts of racial violence and intimidation that didn't result in death, I think the numbers are much higher than that. But certainly they're at least in the several hundred during this time period. You mentioned that the nature of this violence was so horrific, and I think people have heard about the most famous cases like Emmett Till, or maybe even Hattie Carroll in Maryland. Bob Dylan wrote a song about the Ballad of Hattie Carroll. So these were not just murders. They were messages to a community. Certainly lynchings, right, were very visible warnings that this will happen to you if you don't, if you vote, for example. The riot in Ocoee, Florida was all about lynching someone and then saying, this is what happens when you try to go to vote. They were messages of intimidation to an entire community. They about sexuality, about exercising your voting rights, about owning property even. And in towns such as Rosewood, Florida, and in having your own thriving business community. So it is that second part of it, I think, that makes it so important to record as part of our national history, because, of course, murder is horrible no matter who it happens to. But if it can if it carries with it a message of systematic violence and intimidation to send a message of racial supremacy, obviously that's something we need to know in order to solve our problems today as a society. And if governments, such as the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission and other government-related entities, were in any way complicit, we have to know about that so that we don't repeat that mistake.
I want to come back to what you said about things like the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, because that's really a very critical area of our history. But one of the things you wrote about was that the Department of Justice, under the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act that was passed in 2008, mm-hmm. They completed 105 investigations and 3 prosecutions. Can you talk a bit about what it was that what they found in some of these investigations, and who are these 3 that were prosecuted, and what happened?
Yes, well, let me start with the number of cases, and different sources say it was their own Department of Justice report says 105 and 121 victims, and these are actually not all the possible investigations could take place. The criterion, a big criterion in accepting cases to investigate under the Till Act was sort of readiness, ripeness, or possibility of yielding prosecutions. And as you mentioned before, with the passage of time, there are many cases that would not be possible or ripe for prosecution, but they were still very important murders that took place. So of those numbers, the Department of Justice went forward in investigating, and that included actually the Till case, as I mentioned, investigating, contacting possible witnesses, contacting family members. Interestingly, some of the family members in these cases essentially said to the Justice Department, we've been waiting for decades to get a call like this. No one has ever talked to us about what happened to our relatives. So that's a very tragic and moving instance in and of itself. As the Department of Justice went through these cases, there were some that they decided were indeed ripe for prosecution. And so of the 3 that were mentioned, I just want to mention some that actually did result in convictions and incarceration. There was a case going back to 1964 of a Charles Dee and Harry Moore, who were two quite young African-American men who were found in the river that was being dredged looking for the Mississippi civil rights workers, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. And in many ways, this is shocking because these bodies were just found and unidentified at first because the FBI was thinking at the time, this is in the early 1960s, oh, well, we're looking for Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, and we're looking for three bodies, and two of them will be black and one of them will be white. So they find these two black bodies and they think, this is them, or this is two of them. They were not, right? They were Mr. Dee and Mr. Moore. Their family certainly knew that they had disappeared, right? As many, we call them the disappeared. Many, many victims actually just disappeared and were thrown in the river or buried in dams, et cetera. Fast forward to investigations later, many decades later. So it turns out that one of the possible culprits, one of the suspects, is alive, is indeed alive. And the investigations led to, very recently, in the 21st century, an investigation, a trial, conviction, incarceration, some civil settlement between the families of Mr. Dee and Mr. Moore with the local community police department. And this is all because of legislation like the Till Act. It's because of very devoted journalists from places like the Cold Case Project. It's from these cold case initiatives and projects that these cases actually do have a chance. Some of them have a chance of resulting in convictions.
And did people go to jail because of these, the ones that were convicted?
Several have. So of the person who was alive and just living his quiet life, in the Dee and Moore case, there was a conviction. And there was actually, in some of them, there are apologies. They're kind of end-of-life apologies for these murderers. They're sometimes murderers who say, I was a really young man. I was with the Klan. I didn't know what I was. I'm guilty, and I'm very sorry about this episode in my life.
And one thing, when we talked a moment ago about the Emmett Till Unresolved Civil Rights Crime Act, one of the things you posit in this piece is that it's a not just how difficult it is to kind of go after these cases for lots of jurisdictional reasons, but also because this is almost in some senses an underfunded mandate.
Well, that's certainly true, and we all know what's going on in Washington, D.C. in terms of Congress and the chances of progressive legislation. This bill is set to expire in 2017. Mm. It is firmly our hope that it would be renewed. It was introduced initially with a lot of work by Congressman John Lewis. That wouldn't be a surprise to anybody, but many people supported it, and if it is appropriately funded, even with the cutbacks in budgets, it will provide not only or not even primarily for prosecutions, but also for archives, for a nationwide central database of all of the found people, all of the investigated cases. Right now, various cold case projects, the Department of Justice, the Southern Poverty Law Center are working on this separately, and it would be great to have a database, the National Archives, oral histories, that amount of attention paid through a federal mandate in order to ensure that this really important part of our history is understood. Something that Margaret Burnham and I have talked about and think about very much in our writing is the connection between these untreated racial wounds and a sense of a right to truth that other countries have recognized, of truth-telling, of the value of telling truth and actually trying to advance in whatever way some remedies for the past so that we can move forward in dealing with racial crises in this country. Some people have reacted to our article and think generally that the best way to deal with an atrocious past is to ignore it. But other countries have recognized that that is not the way. And I think we can learn a lot from countries like Germany, from countries like Canada that have actually owned up to their exploitation of the past and said, well, an important part of making sure it doesn't happen again is making sure that people know about it.
And I think a part of also that what you're describing here is language often defines how we think about things. And when you refer to the people who were killed over this period of time as the disappeared, mm-hmm. I mean, it's what they call all the people who were killed during the when the fascist regime, the military took over Argentina. They were the disappeared.
Yes.
And people were incensed about the disappeared and what happened to their families and children. But because I think some ways, because the people we're talking about are black, we often don't give it the same weight as the disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I think it's that, and in addition, the U.S. tends to have a sense of American exceptionalism that,
yes.
Oh, we're really different. We can point at what other countries do, but we don't see the parallels in terms of what we're doing in our own country. You know, racism against blacks and the history of that in this country, as you mentioned, certainly has a lot to do with it. But slowly, I think there is an evolving movement, and it's very exciting. The reference to Black Lives Matter is really part of it. This notion that we're going to call attention to every life that is lost, and the importance in doing that is to underscore that they're all important.
You mentioned here several states that are attempting to create commissions on different issues that have affected black communities in their states, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Florida. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, all of those have done their work. So they were commissioned in response to very specific events that happened. The Oklahoma Commission was from late 19th century riot, and that resulted in a really splendid set of reports, very thorough reports with different levels of expertise that was presented to the state, and that's the Tulsa, Oklahoma report. Rosewood, Florida, that was a riot in the early 1920s that leveled the community. That was, an independent, financially stable African-American community with property owners and businesses. The Florida legislature commissioned the report, and after receiving the report, legislation was introduced and passed that actually provided for compensation in the form of reparative payments to descendants of the property owners who could be proven to be descendants of property owners at that time. We in the U.S. tend to think, oh, well, the debate on reparations is over and, you know, that's never happened. But a modest form of that actually happened as a result of the Rosewood Commission.
Hmm.
Another example to look at, not a state commission, but a kind of grassroots, very important commission, comes from Greensboro, in response to an event that happened much more recently, 1979, in Greensboro, in which the Ku Klux Klan murdered five community members. There was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that members of the Greensboro community said, well, we want this to happen even if we're not going to get government support. And they actually convened from 2004 to 2006, and there's some pretty interesting records, both transcripts and a film that's made about the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
And you talk, and part of the issue here has to do with things like Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, restitutions, apologies. It's not all about prosecutions. It's about getting to the heart of this in different ways that can really affect how we know about what we know about our society and where we go from here.
We think that's incredibly important, and in a concrete way. It's not just sort of the pie in the sky, you know, let's see if we can remember the past and just hope people learn from it. I think that there's an international movement of what is called transitional justice, which is paying attention to the processes that democratizing nations adopt in order to emerge from violent past. And so we've seen South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation do that. We've seen a number of other countries have very important commissions. And we may not be able to replicate that, right? I think the idea of a U.S. National Truth and Reconciliation Commission not only would get a lot of opposition, but it would be kind of difficult to implement given that each state has its own specific history. However, the concrete impact of having truth-telling, right, an acknowledgement of truth-telling, an acknowledgement of apology, communities recognizing that their own history involves incredible discrimination. But the idea that, let's say we're looking at, you know, we're asking ourselves as a nation, why is Ferguson happening now? Why is there so much backlash now? Why is there so much focus on police misconduct, police brutality now? Well, you know, we think that there's a pretty, we just connect the dots to our history. It's not so hard to figure out why we still have so many unsolved problems when we look at the ways in which we've pushed the hard parts of our past underground. So our hope is that it's actually a very positive set of steps that we're advancing by acknowledging the importance of telling the truth.
And the part of this, I think, we need to kind of wrestle with as well is your idea, which I think is really a powerful idea. Again, it's going to be hard to figure out how the government will support this, given where the government is. But there may be other ways to do this, which is like the Federal Writers Project, collecting these stories before they're gone, talking to the families, getting these down, so we understand what that history was about.
That's right, and I think it can be done. I don't have great hopes for Congress and the pace of legislation, or even of the amount of money that could be devoted to it. But there are foundations, there are wealthy donors who've set aside money and said, I want to help fix this problem. I was just listening to a story about the effort to invigorate the Newark public schools, right? There's no reason why this wouldn't be a good source of attention and time and money.
So tell me where your work is going. You and Marco Burnham and others who are deep into this, into dealing with the cold cases, the Restorative Justice Project, other things you're working on. Tell me where your work is going.
Yes. Okay. So for quite a while now, Margaret Burnham, who teaches at Northeastern University School of Law, has had a project called the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project. And I can't remember the website name, but if you look up Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project,
yes,
you'll see really such a wealth of information based on the work that she, students, researchers, other professors have done over the years. And part of it is an attempt to collect materials about all the cases they've investigated, the disposition of those cases, other referrals to other cases and other resources. I've been a collaborating researcher with the project way back, from California, which is where I usually work. And that is ongoing. Professor Burnham is working separately on a book describing the cases she has handled and the cases of the project itself, sort of a chronicling of the work of that project. And then she and I and two other co-authors, Professors Nobles and Zoltek Jick, are trying to put together what's really a very accessible compendium of resources beyond the cases. So we would have examples of legislation that other countries have done about historical memory. We'd have, it'd be a good source to go to if you want to know, well, what governmental apologies have been issued, how many Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have existed. We want to have all that together in one place with the specific lens of African-American civil rights experience, because our view is that all of that is relevant to researching the cold cases and also doing something about the injustice that has been covered up, so as to really to improve race relations and a sense of racial justice in the U.S.
We've been talking for this part of our program with Margaret Russell, and by the way, we will connect you on our website to Northeastern University's website for the Civil Rights Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project. So you can see that, and also the articles written here by Margaret Russell, but with and also with Margaret Burnham, the cold cases of the Jim Crow era, which is a powerful story, and we will keep covering because we all need to kind of wrestle with this. And Margaret Russell, A, I want to thank you for your work, and B, I want to thank you and appreciate the time you've given our listeners today.
Thank you so much.
We have to take a very brief break, but when we return, we take a walk through Gallery CA in Baltimore Station North Arts and Entertainment District with Detroit photographer Gracie Xavier. Photography and videography exhibit is called Cuts, C-U-T-Z, Black Men in Focus. It investigates current events, social myths, and personal perceptions surrounding the black male identity, the backdrop of the great African-American barbershops of this city. Stay with us.